I'm an anarchist and a healthcare worker based in the desert southwest, and I was arrested in DC during Trump's inauguration on January 20th, 2017.
My name is Kat. I'm a longtime anarchist from the heartland. I've been involved in various anti-repression campaigns dating back to the early 2000s on the West Coast, doing anti-repression work around forest defense. And I've been involved in anti-police and prisoner support projects. I was not arrested on J20, but I've just been was just involved as a volunteer on the Ad Hoc Defense Committee.
Well, thank you so much both for taking the time to speak with us. Really excited to have this conversation. We're going to be talking about looking back and analyzing the J20 trials, but also the support and the defense and sort of like the groundwork that also happened as well. So let's just start by talking broadly about the J20 case. This really pitted the new Trumpian state up against the J20 defendants. Just explain for listeners, if they're not aware, like what happened and sort of what was at stake in this? What was the government really attempting to achieve?
Yeah, of course. It's been pretty wild that now it's been almost 7 years since the anniversary of January 20th, 2017. And so I'm sure you have a lot of new listeners since J20 was one of the big things happening in anarchy. And so after Trump got elected president, a huge coalition came together in D.C. called Disrupt J20, which organized a mass mobilization to disrupt the inauguration events. There were blockades to stop people from actually entering the events. There was this festival of resistance. There was a lot of different things happening, including a massive anti-capitalist and anti-fascist march, which was a black bloc of many hundreds of people. March only lasted about half an hour, but a bunch of windows and cop cars got smashed up, and there was an immediate, super heavy police response that cattled and mass arrested over 200 people, who initially were charged with felony riot, and a few months later, they came back and charged all of us, everyone that they arrested, almost, they let a few go before that, but with conspiracy to riot, plus 8+ felony charges. That basically turned this from a case of just overcharging to this huge, unprecedented mass conspiracy case that was trying to create mass culpability where everyone who was involved in the march was collectively responsible for everything that happened. And I think we'll probably get some more into some details of it as we talk about what support looked like. But ultimately, we ended up winning. The state was trying to criminalize dissent in a really strong way at the start of the Trump administration, but through collective action, legal strategy, and the massive amount of support we got, as well as the prosecutor's own terrible case, we ended up winning.
It was really a broader and very ambitious extension of the use of conspiracy laws. So they were trying to establish this precedent that people were in a broad conspiracy and, like LP said, creating collective culpability. And they were trying to do this using this liability called Pinkerton liability, where a defendant can be held vicariously liable for the offense committed by someone else of the conspiracy if certain conditions are met. So if that defendant was a party to the conspiracy or the offense was within the scope of the unlawful project, and then if the offense was committed in furtherance of the conspiracy. So they were trying to use this precedent and apply it to conspiracy laws to try to create new legal precedent for repression of activists and protesters. And then the duality of it really was sort of like the process of the prosecution was punishment in and of itself, right? So in addition to trying to establish this new precedent around conspiracy, which we're also seeing in Atlanta, right? There's new legal experimentation to try to create precedent for legal standing. But another aspect of it was really long drawn out legal prosecution that made life really hellish for defendants and really bound up people's energy in that process and created a punishment in and of itself as the legal cases went on.
I think people really need to understand that people were facing 80 plus years in a lot of cases. I mean, for most people, that was a life sentence. I'm sure watching like the J6 stuff play out must have been surreal for you in many ways, having gone through this experience.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And, you know, you say like really wasn't, you know, this march was really, really short. It didn't last for very long, but like, and it got shut down really hard by the police before a lot more happened from that body of people. But the energy was like, it was definitely like one of those moments you could feel in the street as the march was starting, just a really fierce, like, you know, just like energetic presence in the crowd, of people ready to fight back against the Trump administration and resurgent fascism.
You know, J20 defendants were famous for not snitching on each other and staying together as a large group. And as you said, there were hundreds of people that were arrested. So how is this possible? You know, this kind of mirrors what's going on in Atlanta in the sense that there are a lot of people facing charges. How is everybody able to sort of like stay on the same page?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of times with these huge charges and massive repression where that is what the state is trying to push as much as they can. And I think one thing that was really a core part of the press, like the one thing that was a core part of the groundwork that was laid prior to the arrests at J20 was the organizing for the Disrupt J20 movement event emphasized using the St. Paul principles, which were first developed in 2008 during the RNC in St. Paul, Minnesota. And I think especially like the second two of those principles, which focus on, you know, any debates or criticism staying internal to the movement, you know, avoiding any public or media denunciations of fellow activists or events. And the fourth one, which is we oppose state repression of dissent, including surveillance, infiltration, disruption, and violence. We agree not to assist law enforcement actions against activists and others. I think that that was already part of the organizing for this event. So I think that we went into it, and I'm sure definitely not everybody who went to the protest even was aware that that was a part of the organizing, but I do feel like that carried throughout the whole process of collective defense, as an initial stage setting, and then throughout the time, you know, it was really hard to make this group cohesive. It was over 200 defendants. It was people who came to a mass mobilization. The DC organizers really did not anticipate mass arrests because there hadn't been a mass arrest in DC since the early 2000s. And the DC police have these really strict operating protocols about how to deal with protests, which they violated all of on J20. So people really didn't anticipate this to happen. And so there wasn't really a plan for follow-up. And it was a huge effort to get in touch with everyone initially. But luckily there was some super experienced comrades from New York and other places who really jumped into action, seeing what a big deal this was, and started to organize these weekly organizing calls, meetings after hearings. So, you know, we were able to coordinate ourselves and have some centers of communication. And through that, people drafted some points of unity that most defendants signed onto, which included a commitment to not cooperating with the state or harming each other's cases. And I think all of those things helped. I also think that we had a really strong initial bonding experience from, you know, we were all arrested and cuddled on the street corner, held there for, you know, from the morning until after dark, while they slowly arrested people. We went through jail together. So I think we had this really strong initial bonding experience. And then throughout it, there was a continued culture of we are in this together. And I think people really carried that through. I mean, I think in some ways, the state creating a conspiracy case where they were sort of putting us all together. I think we, from that, it helped us really cohese in terms of, you know, a shared sense of risk, a shared sense of what we were going through. And obviously there's like, you know, people had plenty of disagreements and plenty of, you know, internal disagreements, ways they didn't get along with each other, conflicts. But I think overall we created a really strong culture of we are in this together.
And as far as the actual organizing bodies and coordinating around defense that made that possible, when there were, like, it kind of started with regional anarchist networks of people who are already connected, either going into DC or got connected after the arrests. And then from there, it led to spokes council meetings. And then if you weren't from a specific region that had a representative at spokes council, you were welcome to attend the call yourself. And then there were lots of people who were just involved in defense who were not defendants participating in the spokes councils, and created a somewhat informal ad hoc defense committee, that was never like fully named or fully structured. But was largely organized through spokes council calls, a listserv, signal threads, and then that gave way to working groups, which first were focusing on legal strategy and media, and then later were supplemented by political organizing, fundraising, and finance. There was a very robust social media group and organized Twitter campaigns that really helped just with like popular media. And then there was also a wellness working group, and then just a whole number of non-defendant facilitators willing to help facilitate those meetings and those, and some of those working groups, just so all the burden didn't fall solely on defendants. And then there were also like weekly bulletins that summarize updates on legal developments and plea deals, the media campaign, corporate media coverage, political organizing, such as Days of Action and calling campaigns. And then like working group report backs. And a lot of that organizing, as LP already mentioned, gave way to the Points of Unity, which I think was signed by like 130 defendants out of a little over 200 who still had charges, which is really, you know, really significant and important.
Yeah. I think a lot of, you know, some of the folks who ended up not signing it were some of the people who maybe really just put their heads down and focused on their own lives, or we're just not involved in much of the organizing anyway, which is also just how some people relate to it.
Well, yeah, you all said some really amazing stuff, and hopefully we'll get to go back and kind of pick some of that apart. But let's talk about the strategy of the state and the prosecutors.
Right. Well, as you mentioned, that they used all sorts of like insidious specific tactics, which are detailed in various pieces that are published online. But overall, I think what they were essentially trying to do was establish the Black Bloc as a coherent ideology rather than simply a tactic. So the prosecution aimed to synonymize Black Bloc with riot, implying that anyone wearing black near a block is participating in a riot. And it sort of relates to like the other things that were happening at that time, like, you know, pre-COVID anti-mask laws and various anti-protest laws that were enacted at the state level, at various state levels across the country in 2019. And some of those even allowing people to like legally assault protesters in the street with cars if protesters were in the streets.
It really felt like the agents of the state were emboldened by the start of the Trump administration and wanted to see what they could get away with, you know, from the lead prosecutor, Jennifer Kirkhoff, and the entire architecture of the case that she built, to the interim police chief that ordered the mass arrest in the first place, which was like a violation of the DC police protocols. It felt like Trump came into office and these far right people wanted to just really see how far they could take his campaign promises. And we were at the start of this whole specter of Antifa becoming this common fear tactic and something that people are talking about, you know, in all the mainstream media. And, you know, the conspiracy case, what they said bound people together were things like wearing black, marching, chanting, you know, basically all of these elements of being in a protest, became conspiracy to riot. So that included journalists, street medics, legal observers. But I think a really important thing, I think a lot of people look at charges like cases like this and they go, the state loves to overcharge, to force pleas and get people to cooperate. But I think an important part about this case is that using conspiracy law made the overcharging legally viable. My attorney was super clear with me about that, that this case could go to trial and really be up to the jury, because a lot of people described conspiracy charges to me as like the prosecutor's darling. Like, it gives them this really wide range of things that they can create legal culpability for. And so I don't think that this was necessarily trying to overcharge to scare people. I do think it was trying to secure convictions using conspiracy. And I think that we see this in the RICO cases as well, where they want to try to find a way to fully criminalize all these different aspects of being part of a strong resistance movement. In this case, in J20, the prosecutor grouped us up into these different groupings of people who she felt she had a better case against. And she wanted to send the people who she felt she could convict at trial, based on whatever evidence she felt she had, first. We ended up employing getting some people to sign up who felt better about their cases, who had really strong attorneys assigned to them, to choose to do an early trial, to ask for the right for, invoke the right for an early trial, which ended up being successful because all of those people were acquitted. But I really believe the state was trying to win in order to set that precedent. Because I feel like the idea of shared culpability for being involved in non-militant aspects of a protest movement is really one of the state's deepest desires. Like, that will completely destabilize something if just being a part of the protests.
Right. That's such a good point that you're bringing up. I mean, like, you know, now in Atlanta, they're trying to say, like, well, if you write, you know, a jail support number on your arm, then that means you're part of the conspiracy, you know, which is such like a twisted way of thinking about it. Like, if you're worried about the police brutalizing and arresting you for no reason, then therefore you are part of the conspiracy. I just wanted to get your thoughts on, you mentioned the early trial thing, and that's something that we're seeing right now play out in Atlanta. Somebody is going to trial and they're trying to get an early trial right now. I think it's like on hold for a couple weeks, but just explain why that was important. Like, why was that something that people were pushing for? You talked a little bit about it, but if you can just speak a little more on that.
Definitely, yeah. So, as I mentioned a little bit, we had over 200 defendants, and she grouped us up into these group 1, 2, 3, and 4, based on these different roles she felt people had. So she put people in group 1 who she felt were people who were quote-unquote breakers. She felt she had some kind of evidence that those people had vandalized some property or whatever. And when we were choosing trial dates, she had those people set first. A few people invoked an early trial who all had felt good about their cases, and they did end up being able to go to trial before the alleged quote-unquote breakers, and it resulted in full acquittals. And after that trial, about 2/3 of the defendants' charges were dropped. So it was successful because it sort of narrowed down everything, and it also set up, I think, a lot of precedent for the future trials. And we also got all of that, you know, all of the information that comes out in trial about the prosecutor's strategy was revealed in these trials that resulted in acquittals. I think it was a really, in that case, really effective, because it really undermined what her strategy was and gave us so much information and also got a lot of the charges dropped. And then we could focus on the remaining ones.
If I were to add anything, it would just be, I think that it was really brave of people to push for a speedy trial, push for the right for a speedy trial and go first. And it was part of a collective defense strategy that really was underpinned by solidarity with one another, that people were willing to go ahead to try to sort of delegitimize or to break the state's case a little bit or to weaken them because that was the hope, that if they went ahead and it worked, as LP said, to weaken the state's case by putting some people first. And yeah, I think it was just really brave and pretty noble of people to take that risk.
Absolutely. And it was also, it was a risk. And I think that is important to underscore. People felt good about those cases. And some of the people who did the early trial strategy had access to really good attorneys, but they also were taking a risk.
And people had to have individual attorneys, right? Just because this was a conspiracy case, it didn't mean that everyone had collective defense. And very, very few of those lawyers were what would be called a movement lawyer. They were mostly public lawyers secured through DC's like public defense system. And it was, it took a lot of advocating and a lot of educating and intentional educating of lawyers to get them on board with what people really wanted them to do, because they were generally very confused. Lawyers were generally very confused that people would want to invest in collective defense and not just get the best deal for themselves. And they were very leery of that. Like, it was very difficult in a lot of ways to get them to understand that people were trying to, they were invested in a group outcome versus an individual outcome.
You know, one thing I wanted to go back on really quick is that this idea that the police violated their own rules when they did this mass arrest, did that have any repercussions later on? Did they get, like, quote, in trouble for that, or did anything come of it?
It was definitely something that came up a lot in the first trial in terms of, I'm not sure about what came on about in terms of, like, a long-term thing for the police there, but it definitely was part of the ACLU filed a lawsuit early on in the cases on the behalf of a few defendants, that helped pull out a lot of information around all of this. And the standard operating protocols for the DC police was definitely something that was talked about a lot in the first trial. And there was police that were on the stand and they were able to be cross-examined relating to their own protocols. So I do think it was helpful in the trials as well as in later civil suits, afterwards. Because we did have a successful false arrest class action lawsuit after all the charges were dropped.
This is from a question that a friend sent in, which kind of connects to a little bit about what you're saying. It would be great to hear about what was effective building solidarity among defendants, especially if it could be replicated with no contact orders.
Right. I mean, as not a defendant, I don't know if LP could speak to that a little bit better about the way solidarity was really built. I know that there were, defendant meetings, like active assemblies that were held, I think in DC in person as a way to create collective solidarity, like at the very fairly early in this process. But yeah, I don't know if LP wants to speak to this more. That's a real challenge. I guess like the way you're going to get around no contact orders is you're going to have really strong support systems of people who are not defendants who can communicate with each other on behalf of your defendant.
Yeah, the no contact orders are such a huge challenge. And I just really, really feel for anyone in Atlanta going through those cases and going through this experience under no contact order. I can't imagine. That sounds incredibly difficult. And I think I start to think about just, really what are some of the core sort of like feeling and relational things that like helped me move through this experience was, which was, you know, just whatever way we can feel like we are not alone in the process. And for me, a big part of that is really seeing myself in a context of a long history of social movements and seeing myself as connected to a broader struggle, learning more about what like long-term, you know, collective defense, prisoner support, that kind of stuff looks like. And just through whatever direct support networks we have, decreasing that isolation with the people we can have contact with. I think that people with no contact orders, there's definitely like a getting creative and figuring out the ways that you can sort of build a shared identity and a shared experience with each other. But I think that connection to others and to like the movements we're currently a part of and the broad scope of history of movements that we are like active players in these moments, the present moment of history that's like part of like this long history of struggle, I think can really help us move through it, help us know that like no matter what happens, like we're part of this bigger thing. And that this time period that we're in is only temporary.
The key aspects that IGD reported on when this was playing out was the degree of crossover with the far right. I think one of the biggest things that we saw was somebody within the police department. I believe it was somebody, it wasn't a police officer, but I think somebody that worked in the Metropolitan Police literally handed over a list of people that had been arrested to Greg Johnson, who worked for Got News. He's literally a neo-Nazi troll, friends with Richard Spencer. The Republican from Florida, Matt Gaetz, brought him to like a State of the Union speech. He's just a, you know, gross person. And they published that on their website. The state relied on far-right footage, I believe, stuff from the Oath Keepers, I want to say, and also people like Lauren Southern, who's like another white nationalist troll that was live-streaming there. This is not to mention Project Veritas, who had some footage which ended up being a huge liability for the state. We can talk about that. Let's talk about just how that played out, just how the state kind of used a lot of far-right talking points, but also, like, media figures, and how that kind of bled into the trial.
Yeah, this was a huge part of the J20 case. I mean, the conspiracy case really hinged, at least some parts of it, on a video provided by, you know, an undercover right-wing journalist troll from Project Veritas who secretly planned organizing meetings, or secretly filmed organizing meetings. And it wasn't until, so we had, there was an initial, the early trial of, that we talked about, that resulted in full acquittals. And then there was one more trial, that ended in a mistrial. So there was two full trials that played out, in the J20 case. There was the first trial we already discussed, and then there was another trial. And it wasn't until the end of that second trial that it was revealed in a separate hearing for one of the next scheduled trials that the state had edited the video that they were using as evidence to remove a part of it where the person who's filming it says something that implies that he doesn't think the people at the organizing meeting are planning anything. And they also failed to mention that they had about, I think, 69 or 70 other videos from Project Veritas that they did not disclose to the court or to the defense. And so judges really do not like it when prosecutors lie to them and hide things. So she got in really big trouble, which ended up being the final coffin in the nail of their failing case, because she did what's something called a Brady violation, which is where prosecutors withhold potentially exculpatory evidence from the defense. And so part of the sanctions for that for her, part of her punishment for that was that some of the charges got dropped, as well as the footage from Project Veritas could not be used in any future trials. So that resulted in the dismissal of the rest of the remaining cases.
Yeah, which was a huge deal. I mean,
it was massively embarrassing for them. She got in big trouble. I actually kind of like warmed my heart a little bit just to like doing a little bit of kind of research for this podcast, for this interview, going back and looking at, the DC Superior Court, you know, like employment positions, like places where people are, and to see like that Jennifer Kirchhoff, the prosecutor, is still to this day like demoted from where she was when she was doing these trials. Like, it definitely, I'm pretty sure, impacted her career, and that makes me happy.
I was just going to just say, oh, that's good to know, because initially, after the failure of all these cases, she was promoted in her department. And I do, I wonder, I'm like, where is she now? Where is Jennifer Kirchhoff now?
I think she's just like she covers misdemeanor trials, I think, before she was like the chief like felony trial officer. So someone probably knows more, and maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think she's doing too good.
To go back to this period too, like as you were saying, as this was playing out, there was this huge sort of boogeyman that was created that sort of originated on the far right, but I mean it really kind of worked its way into the center. I've mentioned this before, but there was this study that came out right before Charlottesville that talked about how in mainstream publications there was actually more editorials and opinion pieces that were published in like big mainstream magazines and newspapers that attacked anti-fascists than there were that were talking about the growth of the far right or the alt-right. So, I mean, there was this huge sort of kind of like scare that was building around, you know, anarchists, the Black Bloc, Antifa, sort of in kind of nebulous terms. But one of the things that's interesting is that despite this, I think toward by the end of the trial, kind of the things had turned and that the J20 defendants really began to rightfully, you know, in my opinion, be seen as people that, you know, went out on the streets, took a risk to push back against Trump and really kind of like set the tone that people were going to fight this stuff. They weren't just going to sit idly by and tweet on Twitter about, you know, how much they didn't like Trump and kind of like wait for the next election or something. They were actually going to do something about it. And I'm curious if you can talk about sort of the media strategy that went into getting the word out, getting stuff written about the case, and just not kind of letting it fall by the wayside that people actually cared about what was happening, because this became a very big story.
Yeah, well, as aforementioned, there were a lot of people really involved in creating like a media strategy for this specific campaign, which involved both like working with movement media, you know, working with our own media resources and coordinating stories within that, coordinating Twitter campaigns. Like there was like, it was like sort of in the more like earlier in the heyday of Twitter where it was a really effective way to get information out. And then also working both like with like, sort of allied or movement based journalists who worked more in the mainstream media. And some people put out some really, really good work about these cases and about the implications of them. And I think that there was definitely a leap made at some point, about really trying to educate people about the grave implications of these cases. Should they be, should the state win? And that goes like far beyond like what it would mean for anarchists, but what it would mean for organizing, and organizers, activists in general. And I think that was just a really successful media strategy to make the leap from this affects this very small group of people to like, to broaden the campaign to be more like, this is a, you know, this is sort of an assault on democracy and the First Amendment. And that's not necessarily the gravity of what these cases were really about, but it's also not untrue, right? And that sentiment taps into a lot broader, of a population's concern than some of the more intricacies and specificities of the case in general.
It was definitely difficult to come up with media strategy, I think, initially, because we're representing so many different people. You have over 200 defendants trying to figure out how to make talking points and represent in the media in a way that's going to most represent everyone. There's influence of fear and paranoia with the conspiracy charges about like, what can we talk about, what can't we talk about, wanting to be really intentional. But we had a group of folks who were defendants working with folks who were not to collaboratively come up with talking points. And then some people would speak to the media. We'd also have press releases, etc. And I think there was a really big question of, you know, what would win in the case and what would really appeal to the broader left. And I think over time, we did really start to develop a thing that spoke to a lot of different people. And it kind of maybe boiled down the case to, like you say, maybe something a little bit more kind of First Amendment-y. And I think that there are a lot of people who were then and maybe still frustrated that some of the media that was done around the case was not more focused on anarchism or maybe some more of the militant aspects of the march that day. But I think we were trying to drum up support to as many people as possible. And I think that we were effective in getting people to really see themselves in it and see the implications for others. I think a lot of the common lines were like, you know, the chilling or criminalization of dissent, criminalizing protest, you know, this idea that what's happening to the J20 protesters should frighten anyone concerned about protest and free assembly and, you know, color coordination is not a crime. And I think that we were really effective in that. And I think it's really interesting that you noticed that shift because I hadn't really thought about it in that way. But maybe we did have some effect on that in a broader sense, whether or not we intentionally meant to do that or we were just trying to, you know, come up with the most winnable media talking points.
Oh, yeah. It went from like, oh, some people in black broke some stuff and now they're getting in trouble, to like, oh, this is actually has ramifications for everybody that protests. And, you know, there's a lot of people doing that right now under Trump. You know, there's a lot of people that don't like what's going on. I mean, I don't know how you all feel, but one of the things that makes me feel hopeful is that that seems to be sort of kind of like the understanding baseline going into the Atlanta cases, is that, yeah, it's really messed up when you have people facing conspiracy charges just for going to a concert where something happened. I mean, this is just like a blatant violation of civil liberties, and they're just trying to, you know, expand the scope of this thing because they're terrified of people, you know, being part of this movement. They're even trying to stop people from literally signing a petition to get this thing on the ballot, you know?
There are a lot of similarities between these cases. You know, even though the Atlanta arrests are all over the matter, like that's like a much longer span of time, right? They're casting an even wider net. They're not tying it to one specific event or one specific moment. But it's the same sort of experimentation, trying to set, you know, they're doing some legal experimentation to see if they can cast a new precedent with these RICO laws. So there's a lot of similarities between Atlanta and the J20 case.
Definitely. And the thing I wanted to add was about, in terms of the media strategy, I think that throughout the J20 cases, we had a strong dedication to trying to working against the good protester, bad protester narrative. You know, I think a lot of people watching the case really did focus in on the, like, well, you could just be like walking on the street or like and get caught up in this and now you have these conspiracy charges, you know, while at the same time there were windows broken and cop cars smashed. And we kind of just turned the focus away from talking about that in the media. And I think that hopefully in some ways it made people just be like not actually feel as upset about like some broken windows. Like liberals have historically gotten like really upset about some like stupid windows. And I do think though, like for maybe a variety of different reasons, we've seen that shift in the US of people really not being so upset about the idea of like some property destruction. I mean, George Floyd rebellion, I think, was like incredible in terms of that, the amount of people in the United States who approved of a police station getting burned down. They're like, yeah, that seemed necessary. So I do think that hopefully this is like part of a broader shift to people being a little bit also more accepting of some of those tactics, or at least like less, you know, fully just upset by them.
But I mean, there was also like calls for calling campaigns. There was calls for weeks of solidarity. People did a lot of things like organizing benefit events. There was, you know, educational events organized. How did that play into things? Just these kind of constant stream of solidarity events.
Yeah, I think those things kept people engaged. They helped defendants feel supported and less alone. They helped raise money. I think that the consistency of all of those events were super helpful. You know, we had a speaking tour. We had speaking events around the country. There was bands that would let people table on tour with them. And so I think just all of those actions just helped drum up awareness, money, and just decreasing the isolation. There was a lot. I mean, it's like trying to go back through. I'm like, there was so many different things. There was yard signs in D.C., there was like this like funny, like, wheat pasting campaign that happened in D.C. about the cases. There was so many different things.
Yeah, there were podcasts that were put out continually. Let's see, I think about the trials and trial updates and that call-in campaign. Let's not, you know, that was like, it was a, like, significant, pressure that was directed towards, Kirchhoff's office. You know, people were pretty relentless and, at the very least, it was an extreme annoyance.
You put a lot of pressure on them. I mean, they were getting lots and lots of calls. So it was just a constant reminder that what they were doing was not popular.
Right. I don't want to, I'm not trying to like resign it to a mere annoyance. I think it was a significant tactic. I think it put a lot of pressure on their office.
We've talked a little bit about this, but you know, the support work that went into the campaign, you know, what can we say about that aspect of the work? Just the actual support and caring for people.
Right. I mean, there were thousands and thousands of hours of volunteer labor put into these cases. And I think that ranges from people doing media strategy to legal strategy to actually, you know, trying to take care of and support defendants. Many of these people did not know each other before arrests, as been previously stated. And it shouldn't be understated how much work people took on under tremendous amounts of stress that were happening. And then defendants having to make weighty decisions while scared and isolated, trying to figure out how to move forward. And I think that there was a lot of effort into putting forward a strong and united front, even with like, tensions underlying, and tensions and conflict and underlying some of the organizing that was going on. And I would like to think that like just that those aspects of like all of these people putting in forward so much effort like helped create some amount of like an environment of care for people, right? Like that, like this, like the extension of solidarity really helped create an environment of care, even if people didn't always feel like they were as supported as they possibly could be, if that makes sense. But just having like a whole bunch of people being in solidarity with one another, creating a baseline to move forward.
Yeah, the support that went into the J20 case was truly incredible. The amount of work and support that people not facing charges put into it, and the support of defendants by defendants for each other. I mean, we had like wellness working group. We had people sending us like herbal medicine. We had people who came to cook meals for everyone during the trials. We were really lucky. I mean, I think a lot of times I just felt so grateful because like so many people going through the legal system in really scary ways have like no support. And I think one of the amazing things about facing charges as part of, you know, a participant in a social movement is just how much support that you get and how incredibly helpful it is. And we're not entitled to it. A lot of people not facing charges are just doing all that stuff with their free time, or it's their friends or their family members that they're trying to support. And then they're extending that support to other people who are also facing the same thing. But there's so many details. Happy to elaborate on other like, details about what the support looked like. If there's further things to go into. I mean, there was definitely not all the defendants in the case were involved in organizing or supporting each other. I think that there was a smaller group of us who were able to focus our attention on that. But that was still for, you know, everyone, regardless of how much time and capacity they had.
You know, as we've talked about, just like in Atlanta, so much of the state's case seems to be around attacking anarchism. I feel like in Atlanta, it's maybe even more so. I know like in the J20 case, like people's membership to the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, was considered evidence. How did people push against this during the trial? This sort of kind of like making up of the specter or the boogeyman of anarchism.
Yeah, they're obsessed with the IWW. It's like, it's so 100 years ago, you know? It's just like wild that they're, I don't know, it's just funny that they're obsessed with that in this case too. Just like, sorry. Side note. But I feel like in J20, I think in some ways anarchism was on the back burner in some of the ways that we like fought back in a really like clear way. I think a lot of the focus became around the absurdity of the state's assertions and the things that they were trying to criminalize, such as like color coordination, like chanting. I think in the Atlanta case, like, the things that they're trying to criminalize are even more absurd. And so I think that we were kind of like trying to just normalize what people were doing and normalizing the things that the things that the state likes to get like really spooky about, as just being regular stuff, like regular parts of protest movements, and kind of just like pushed back on the absurdity of the state's assertions. I think sometimes in ways that we're like, you know, making fun of it, and just normalizing it.
Right. I would also add that like, solidarity regardless of guilt was a guiding tenet. So rejecting the legitimacy of the legal system, and recognizing the ways it upholds fundamental injustices for all sorts of populations, really helped anchor the way that people push back against the J20 case. And instead of playing into the trope of good protester versus bad protester, people push back against the state and identified it as an enemy, refusing the narrative that there were, yeah, good protesters exercising their First Amendment rights while there were only a few bad apples that spoiled the day.
To wrap things up a little bit, you know, looking back now, what are some of the key lessons that we can draw in terms of looking towards the situation in Atlanta, you would say?
I think a main takeaway of the J20 case is, like, regardless of how difficult it was that solidarity gets the goods. You know, people had to stick together and really advocate for themselves, their friends, their loved ones, but for yourself, that you have to advocate for yourself, and not let your lawyer push you around, and really advocate for, like, collaboration if that is what you want. I think broadening the case to make clear the wider implications, which I think overall that campaign has done an amazing job at, that the way they've drawn all of these secondary and tertiary connections between Cop City and indigenous land struggles, black liberation struggles, you know, the connections to the Israeli state and so on and so forth. But politicizing the case and drawing these larger connections with other movements. And then just having collective efforts as much as possible. Like, I know that like these no contact orders are incredibly difficult to get around, but create good communication, between support crews, concentrate on media strategies. If possible, concentrate on like financing. Like, I think that is one of the things that I understand, like, is very complicated. You know, I think I know that there is the Atlanta Bail Fund, and that is centralized. But as far as like the support campaigns, because this group of people is so disparate and, varied, that there's support crews doing fundraising individually. And I understand that, but I wonder if there's any way to collectivize any of the funding, you know, like with J20, again, very different case. There were 9 funds prior to the creation of a central fund, and that central fund, while like we're always going to fight and argue about resources and money, especially in the US where like we have a lot of, real stratification and resources happening. But I think like it helped with when that fund was centralized, it helped broaden the context of the case in general. And then there was like one central place people could go to donate. Again, I don't know, like in Atlanta, like I understand why that might not be possible. Like there's so many different people with so many different needs at play, in this. And that just ultimately people need to like just try as much as they can to stay involved in their legal defense. You know, it shouldn't be overlooked that the omission of video evidence was found by another defendant poring over data, right? Because they were so involved in their own case. Again, I understand that that's not possible for everyone, but hopefully volunteers can make up for like what people don't have, to give themselves, because like it is very daunting to be facing, such extreme repression by the state.
Everything that Kat said, and you know, every case is different, and there are parallels that we can draw between J20 and the situation, the RICO cases in Atlanta, and also, yeah, lots of big differences. DC was a really different, like, legal landscape. And there's all of these different tactics we can look at. And to me, ultimately, through the relationships that we cultivate with each other, with ourselves, our relationship to, like, the case that we're involved in, and the culture that we create around that and the core of our ethics, you know, guide so much that then can lead into the specific tactics that we use. Seeing yourself as connected in with the bigger struggle I was already mentioning, and really, I think, learning to work through like a mental and emotional, like, total roller coaster and wild ride that it is to be a defendant in this case and be someone supporting defendants through these kinds of cases. Because they are designed to, you know, they are designed to mess with us. And I think it can be so overwhelming, that we either want to shut it out or want to react against the people who are trying to help us. And I super understand that feeling, but I think there's like a lot of needing to accept help and really, you know, want to emphasize again, getting involved in your own case, you know, using it as a way to learn as much as you can. You know, I had been involved in anarchist stuff for over a decade before I became a J20 defendant, but I had never really been involved in anti-repression work or, you know, legal support, collective defense kind of things. And I really engaged myself and I learned so much. And I feel like that has helped me be able to help and support other people. So I just took it for as much as I could to learn as much as I can, because it was just the situation that I was in. And it kind of derailed me from my other life goals for a couple of years. And it is really important, you know, to remember that, yeah, it's not over till it's over. Like, they haven't convicted anyone until they do. And while it's really important to come to terms with the worst possible outcomes, of a case and to, you know, kind of emotionally reconcile that, even though we prepare for the worst, we gotta hope for the best and not imprison ourselves before we get there. Or I know that there's people who have spent a lot of time and some folks who are still inside, and still hoping for the best outcome for everyone's cases. And that, you know, the more that we engage ourselves in those support networks, the more that we can, you know, set ourselves up to be a part of movements, you know, no matter where we end up or how the cases end up. I think in J20, something, the spokes council model and coordinating different groups method was also really helpful, because people could kind of focus in more on, you know, the region or where they were, and then, you know, come together, in a bigger way. But I think, you know, continuing to build that, like, collective interest, like I mentioned earlier, like the spirit of, like, the St. Paul principles, and how do we build that into our organizing and, organize together around our cases to, help inspire others in the future and build the kind of cultures of resistance that we want. At the end of the day, it's like up to people who are involved to, you know, take from all the different things that they're learning and figure out how to apply it to their current situation.
I've only lived through this as a supporter, you know, and I haven't lived through it as a defendant. And I think, like, getting through the fear and the intimidation of facing serious prison time is so much of getting through the case, right? Like far outside the legal bounds and the legal precedent and like what it means for everybody else is like what it means for individuals and how you feel, like how you feel on the daily as you move through it. You know, and I think one of the things that spoke to me was when you were talking, LP earlier about grounding yourself in a larger tradition of resistance and that making what's happening a little bit more literate to you. And like holding time long, like if people can hold time long, even though like, you know, and understand like the long lineage, both the people are, you know, the long history that this context is happening in, and then personally hold time long for like people's lives, like what, where this can impact and where it can fall, and that like this is happening right now, but it won't always be happening.
It won't always be happening, and it's going to change in some way. And I think as much as we can ground ourselves in something bigger, as well as like just talking to people who've been through it before, however you can, I think moving through that fear and anxiety and feelings of isolation can really just help us do all the rest of these things.
I think one of the amazing things about the J20 case is it shows how people, you know, supported each other, stood together in the face of, you know, possibly doing so much prison time, but also kind of flipped the script on the state and really turned that against them and made this sort of a, you know, something that ended up looking bad for them in the end. I mean, you talked about the prosecutor already, but I mean, this was not a win for them. You know, definitely it was something that ended up looking really bad. And one of the good things for Atlanta defendants is that it also is a precedent to now look on for their case as well, you know, as bad as it is that they're facing those charges, of course.
Yeah, definitely. And it absolutely is terrifying, like, while you're going through it. I mean, the levels of, like, stress that, you know, I was at and probably, like, you know, long-term, you know, health implications of that are years taken off my life. But I'm like, but I got through it and I learned a lot. And then we also, in that case, were able to sue them and get some money out of that. And that was also nice.
Well, any closing thoughts that you all want to share?
As much as people can remember that they are not alone, even when they feel like they are, you know, both like, yeah, politically, emotionally.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I think it is a really scary thing. And I think I also want to encourage people who are like, who are defendants to not get caught up in this sort of dualism of defendants as being the people who are, you are the person who's like maybe most affected in this moment. But I think that there's some ways where we can sort of push away people who are trying to help us because they don't understand what's going on, because they're not experiencing it, and sort of like separate ourselves away. This was definitely something I think, you know, we have to try to work against a lot in J20 stuff, like, against these like non-defendant support comrades who don't understand what's going on or are trying to tell us what to do. But I think, again, coming back to seeing ourselves like in this movement and the fact that people are, you know, we're all in this together because, you know, what happens to one person, especially in these precedent setting sort of shared culpability cases, really does affect everyone and has huge implications for everyone who's involved in resistance movements. So just say trying to like, you know, recognize within ourselves when we're doing that, and to see ourselves part of the collective action. And there's so many, and there's so many other things you can look at in terms of like, you want to look into some more details about, you know, J20 stuff. And I know hopefully there'll be some stuff in the show notes about that for more details and learning as much as you can about what people have done in the past. The last thing that has also been said by one of my former co-defendants that I think moving forward in social movement and how do we prepare for these kinds of things is just like, we need to continue to create a culture where when people go to mass actions and demonstrations, we sort of have a presumption that if there are mass arrests, we are going to do collective defense and we see ourselves as part of a movement in that way. That we already know going into that, that we're committed to non-cooperation with the state. You know, I think when we sticking together is how we get to the best outcome, but you know, creating cultures of that at large in general before we go into things. Yeah, I think that's part of the movement I want to see for sure.
So I have one last crowdsourced question. What was the funeral for a Starbucks window? Do y'all remember that one?
I am, like I said earlier, I was like, right, this is like the test on really old information. It is vaguely familiar. I'm trying to troll my brain.
Okay, well, if you don't remember it, then I guess it's not as funny. Do you remember?
I feel like I'm like that. There's like so... It's wild. There's so many different things. I'm like, that sounds like something that like probably happened in like North Carolina or something. But like, I don't remember that one specifically. I mean, my favorite thing that happened on all of the J20 saga is when during the jury deliberations of the second trial, a juror passed a note to the judge that they had seen the words Google jury nullification written in Sharpie on the bathroom stall. And then they discussed it with their fellow jurors and the judge let them keep going. But I think that's one of my favorite things that's ever happened. So it dominates my memory a little bit.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.